New York area listeners, just a reminder, Andrew Talks to Chefs is doing our first live show at the Brooklyn Podcast Festival. Join us at the Bell House in the Gowanus neighborhood of Brooklyn on Saturday, January 12th at 2:30 p.m. with special guests Tom Colicchio, Greg Backstrom, Alex Raj, and Alan Harding, plus a live performance of our theme music and other songs by the Brooklyn-based band Fathers. Tickets are $15, but with the promo code Andrew, they are yours for just $10. Visit ATTC, that's short for Andrew Talks to Chefs, ATTCBKPodfest.eventbrite.com, or if that's too long to remember, visit the event page on my blog, tokeland.com/appearances. Hope to see you there.
The Heritage End of Year Fund Drive is officially on. Become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stone.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
And I was very well aware of the difference between like Piedmonte and Sicily. You know, they're both Italy, but they're really, really different.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about Southern food in that way, variations of, say, Richmond, Virginia to New Orleans and the differentiation there. And then I started thinking about, well, in the 80s, I would dare to say, before, you know, Mario Batali and the Food Network and all
yeah.
of those things,
yeah.
I don't think people were thinking about the regional variations of Italian cuisine
no.
pretty much at all.
No.
It was American
Northern
Italian.
Southern.
Well, just American Italian spaghetti and meatballs, you know what
right,
I'm saying?
Right.
So I started to think more deeply about how the Southern cuisine really consists of these little micro cuisines,
mm-hmm.
just subdividing the South into five subregions.
That is Chef Rob Newton of Gray and Dudley Restaurant in Nashville, Tennessee. Our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and today's guest is an old friend of mine. This is sort of a holiday chat between friends that you're about to be pulling up a chair to and listening in on. Rob was the chef of some prominent restaurants in the Carroll Gardens neighborhood of Brooklyn. Seersucker was his first one where he got pretty well known. Then he had Nightingale 9, which was kind of an interesting place that combined Southern and Vietnamese food in a way that probably mentally only made sense to Rob, but made sense to everybody else once he got it up and running and we were all able to taste that. He had a fried chicken and Southern food joint called Wilma Jean and a place called Smith Canteen, which was sort of a coffee, pastry, sandwich, and soup grab-and-go place in that neighborhood. And Rob, after about 20 years in New York, he originally was from Arkansas, had come up here, worked at places like Le Cirque, paid his dues, then opened these restaurants. And he has just recently returned to the South, not to Arkansas, but to Nashville, Tennessee, where he is the chef of a restaurant called Gray and Dudley. He was back in New York for the Heritage Radio Network Holiday Gala. Rob was instrumental in getting us use of the space where we do that event because he has a restaurant in that space that he was associated with. And we got together on a rainy Sunday. We had lunch at Wu's Wonton King, which if you're a cook in New York City, you probably know. It's one of the kind of industry's favorite place to go for Chinese food these days. It's pretty wonderful. It's not a fancy place, but it's also not expensive. The food's wonderful. And we had lunch, and then we kind of commandeered a common space at the hotel where he was getting ready to check in. And we did our interview right there in the second floor lobby, I guess you would call it. I don't know that I need to say much more about it. It's like I said, it's a conversation between old friends. We talk about what it was like to come to New York from the South and then to go back from New York down to the South. We talk a little about a cookbook that Rob has coming out next year and what that experience was like for him. And I think that's all I'm going to say about it. You might also be able to tell that I'm fighting something, and my voice is going to give out on me soon. Anyway, with all that, this is my interview with Chef Rob Newton, recorded in Lower Manhattan a few weeks ago. Okay, so first of all, Rob, it was great to see you.
Good to see you, man. I'm really excited to be on your show. I've been a fan. I haven't listened to every single one of them, but I've been a fan of all the ones that I've listened to. And I think you're doing an important thing
in the ship space. Thank you.
So I'm your friend, and I'm a fan. And
thank you.
I'm really psyched to be here.
I feel the same way about you.
Thank you. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you. We're both very full. We just went to Wu's Wonton
King. Yeah.
For lunch.
It's the king of all Chinese restaurants.
And it was awesome.
Love that place.
I let you do the ordering. But how long have you been out of New York now?
It's been kind of a slow-moving exit. I don't know, 8 months maybe?
8 months since you...
Did a lot of back and forth when I first left.
A lot of road trips?
Yeah, less to Nashville. Get fly trips. I do love a road trip.
But, yeah.
Nashville's a little far.
Yeah,
for that. It's 14 or something like that, so it's a bit much for me.
So you've been back just for like about a day. What's it like coming, as someone who grew up in the South, mm-hmm. you were in New York for a long time.
True.
And what's it like when you come, like what feels like home now?
Oh, that's a great question.
Back to New York, what's the feeling?
Familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of home, but it also kind of never felt like home because I'm not from here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Arkansas, not Tennessee, but I'm about 7 hours now from where I primarily grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, it feels kind of good. It feels...
like you're in your element?
Yeah, I think so. I think if I was 20 years younger or had not had the experience of living in New York City, I might get bored. But where I am in my life now and the opportunity that presented itself and being closer to my family, that all feels right.
Well, tell us about the restaurant where you are now.
It's a restaurant within a hotel. The hotel group is called 21C.
Mm-hmm.
I've liked them for a very long time. They're based originally out of Louisville, and now they have property in Cincinnati, Bentonville, Arkansas, which is about 3 hours where I'm from, Oklahoma City, Kansas City, Durham, Lexington, Kentucky.
Yeah.
I think that's all. I don't know. I just like what they do. I'm the chef of a place called Gray & Dudley. It's in Nashville,
mm-hmm.
21C Nashville.
And that restaurant, that is the restaurant at that hotel?
Correct.
So in each place, they have a unique...
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, each one is very, chef-driven, which has its own connotations these days. But
yeah.
Each one has a distinct perspective, I would say that.
Uh-huh.
That's very accurate. And it's been open for about a year and a half. I've been there since June, so I took over for a previous chef. And, I'm having a really good time. It's different. I've kind of gone in reverse because having had a partner in ownership of restaurants here.
Yeah.
It's different to go and, be employed as an executive chef, but I don't know. After doing it for almost a decade, it's like there's some enjoyment in there because I get to focus more on the food and mm-hmm. just make the food and not mm-hmm. have to worry about when's the Department of Health coming or is the grease trap going to overflow today or all of the what I sometimes call the myth of chef ownership.
What do you mean by that? This has never come up before. This is great.
I don't know. New York was great to me. I had a great time. Very challenging time as well of restaurant ownership, but somebody's got to be the person that deals with the grease trap or mm-hmm. the bathroom mm-hmm. or when Con Ed calls at mm-hmm. 1 a.m. and somebody, I guess in Brooklyn it's National Grid, when you smell gas, like somebody has to deal with that.
Yeah.
And that takes you so far away from, oh, how are my dumplings today? Or mm-hmm. how's the pho broth tasting? You're just so...
Yeah.
It's just a whole other hat that you have to wear.
Well, it's funny, Caitlin, a lot of listeners know Caitlin.
Of course.
But Kate,
of course.
Has a big corporate job now, but she had been a publicist, and then she and a friend started their own PR agency. The agency still exists, but she sold out of it. And, most people would probably think that's kind of the pinnacle, right? If you're in that business, she hated being an owner.
Mm.
Hated it. Hated worrying about payroll, hated hiring and you still have to hire and whatnot, but she hated all that stuff. She's very happy now being employed by a big corporation where you have an HR department and you have, all that stuff.
Yeah. HR, yeah. I mean, I see both sides. I'm not in any way, shape, or form trying to, you know, sound mad about it. It was just, it just presents a challenge. Small business ownership is very challenging. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Do you sleep better now?
Probably. Yeah. I was still like a little PTSD. It's all very kind of fresh. You know what I mean? But yeah,
that's pretty funny.
The overarching answer to your original question is, yeah, I feel very comfortable being back in the South. And, you know, my book is coming out, Seeking the South, and we'll talk about that eventually, I'm sure.
We
but
will.
I felt really committed to the idea of being back where I'm from for when this book comes out, not just because the book is coming out, but it's also, I don't know, it's probably a bigger story, but 20 years is enough in New York City for me and other lives, you know, life happens and sometimes you got to go a different direction.
Yeah.
So it's a culmination of events.
Well, you kind of did it, right? I mean, you came here as a young cook. What are some of the places you worked? Tell people where you worked when you first got here. You came in the 90s?
Yeah, I moved here in 97.
Mm-hmm.
I got really lucky or really abused or both by getting a job at Le Cirque 2000 like 5 days after I got here.
Wow.
I sent Sota. I really wanted to, even then I was really into this idea of Asian things mixed in with French things. And
is that what drew you to that restaurant?
Of course, yeah.
Okay. 100%. So Sota Kun, so for people who don't
Sota's
know, he was
a French trained Cambodian chef who took over when Danielle, I think Sylvain, wasn't it Danielle, then Sylvain Porte, and then Sota? Was that right?
That I'm not sure of, but Sota, I think, worked for Danielle.
Oh, yeah, for like a decade.
Yeah.
And maybe Robuchon, too. So, yeah, that was the motivating factor. To come to New York, the motivating factor was, like, to kind of prove it to myself that I can do it. But because I'm from Arkansas, and I went to culinary school in Vermont, and it's like, well, if I'm going to do it, I just need to go. Can you swear on this show or not?
Really? Yeah, you can.
I just need to go fucking do it. So,
although I pointed this out before, people always ask that, and then they swear once.
Swearing.
No, they swear once, and then like that's it. Never, it goes away.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, I hear you. So yeah, that's what I did, and I got lucky enough to be tortured there for a little bit over a year.
Yeah.
6 days a week is pretty insane. I really didn't know what I was doing though, because going from culinary school into like a hardcore kitchen like that is
that's insane.
Nobody's ready for that. You know? Nobody, and you can't do anything right when you're fresh out of school, literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
But it was a great learning experience, and I have fond, challenging memories of that time. And that's kind of where it started for me.
Yeah. And where'd you go from there? What are the highlights?
Opening team of Tabla with Floyd, who
Floyd Cardoz. That was a Danny Meyer project.
Yeah, I found. Yeah, totally. I found that in writing my book and just sort of. This sounds so weird to say, but when you're sort of getting a deeper understanding of what your own personal cuisine is, which sounds like such a weird, narcissistic thing to say. I don't know.
Isn't that you have to have that now?
You do, I guess.
If you want to operate
it. It's a natural progression of a chef, but to say it out loud sounds a little narcissistic. But anyway, going through that process of writing the book with Jamie, my co-writer, I just found over the course of that process and recipes that I had done at the restaurants and some that I never did at the restaurants, Floyd's thumbprint is like kind of all over.
Really?
Yeah.
I
really enjoyed my time there. The spices, for lack of a better word, like the ethnic cuisine of it all, you know, that's something that's been running through me pretty much since I went to culinary school, which is kind of how I wound up, you know, spending time in Vietnam and having a Vietnamese restaurant. But it was also very present in my desires when I came to New York to work for a French-trained Cambodian chef and then to go work for Floyd. I guess the point I'm trying to make is his sort of culinary DNA is sort of all over what I do, just like an approach and spices.
Because he sort of like personalized a type of food?
I just like his approach. It was like an influential time for me as a cook. You know, I was like my second job in New York City. I think it's when a lot of things clicked for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's when things sort of came together and I maybe sort of became a cook there as opposed to being a Le Cirque when I was just kind of like trying to keep my head above the water
trying
not to die.
Trying not to get screamed at.
Yeah. And I was, it's whatever.
So, you know, you got known here at, you know, the restaurant you did up here for doing your take on Southern food, right?
Sure.
You had Nightingale, Nightingale 9, which sort of combined it with Vietnamese. You had Seersucker, and you had Wilma Jean, right? So here's my question. Is there a difference doing what you did with Southern food here in New York City versus thinking of a menu, thinking about your diners, thinking about what you're going to put out there?
How much time do you have?
You're in the South. When you're in the South.
Of course.
Talk to me about this.
Shit, man. I don't want to get into all that.
What? You really don't?
Because it's so loaded. No, of course we'll talk about it. People have stereotypes in their brain and connotations and images of what Southern food is.
Mm-hmm.
And they have those same things about what Vietnamese food is, whether mm-hmm. they travel the country like I was lucky enough to do
mm-hmm.
or went there to smoke weed for 2 weeks with a backpack. You come mm-hmm. back thinking you know everything there is to know about pho. And
mm-hmm.
I'm making a broad sweeping generalization. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But people come to these two cuisines, which I happen to love, a little bit more loaded than they would with their thoughts on like meatloaf or something. You know what I mean? It's just more, they're polarizing. You know, people feel very strongly about Southern food mm-hmm. because it's probably the greatest cuisines of America. You know, I can't think of another cuisine that would rival Southern cuisine in America.
You know what's funny?
You think about the food of Utah? Like, not so much. You know?
You're not speaking specifically of barbecue, but I was talking to someone recently and they mentioned barbecue. And I said, you know, I hadn't really thought about it, but you could kind of say, you know, people say like, well, now you would add other types of music to the mix, right? But people used to say jazz was like the one original American music, right? And I kind of feel like that dovetails with the comment you just made,
mm-hmm.
you know, that is the original
I definitely
American
truly
food.
That.
Yeah.
So when you're in that position as a cuisine, people are going to have very strong opinions about you.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you...
About you.
No, not me as a human, as the cuisine.
Yeah, yeah.
People are going to have strong opinions about you,
what cuisine. You're doing, right.
No, not even me, not okay. personalizing. Like,
the food.
People are going to have strong opinions about how that food is given to them or presented mm-hmm. to them or prepared for them.
Mm-hmm.
So by extension, when you're a guy like me who's from the South, you know, lived in... My family's been in Arkansas since the 1800s, and I spent some time in Mississippi when I was little. And then to come to New York, and having been here at that time, like a dozen years, half of which was spent, you know, being a fancy private chef for a guy with airplanes and stuff, to just pop up out of the earth and open this Southern restaurant with no one really knowing anything about you, not even really knowing if you're from the South, you're going to have a lot of people... You know, apply those notions of, well, that's not my Southern food, or why is this guy doing Southern food? I don't know anything about him. And that's all fine and dandy and fair. And
how did this make itself known to you? In other words, did people question you, like, in person directly? Was it stuff that you read? Was it just a vibe you picked up from people?
Oh no!
How explicit was this?
I don't think anybody's mad about it. It just the conversation started happening when I got interviewed for the Oxford American about, can you make Southern food outside of the South? I thought that was just a ridiculous thing, but I participated in the interview because, but this is crazy. Why can't you?
What was the thesis
people
of the...
Some of the foundations of American cuisine were by French chefs making French food here. No one ever asked them the question, like, how dare you make French food in America?
Right.
That's just insane.
Yeah.
So the notion that I couldn't do true, good Southern food, especially in this day and age with FedEx and, you know, you can get sorghum and Kentucky soy sauce on Amazon Prime delivered tomorrow.
Yeah.
I think it's just a crazy, ridiculous notion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if I'm honest, I feel like there's a lot of...
Is anybody telling Italian chefs they're not making good Italian food in New York City?
No one's having that conversation. No, I feel like there's... you know, without getting particular about it, I feel like there are a lot of articles, you know, and things that have come out in the last several years that are kind of much ado about nothing,
mm-hmm.
that are sort of... I don't know, like, it's not just enough to write about food and celebrate it and or review it or whatever, but you know, we have to kind of make it controversial,
yeah.
You know, and sometimes I feel like it's kind of forcing it a little bit. Like, that's, I didn't see the piece you're describing. That sounds to me like you're kind of forcing it, you know.
Perhaps.
whoever.
I just think, like, take Missy Robbins, for example. She's making some of the best food in New York City. And yep. If you took her food and did it in Italy, it'd probably be some of the best Italian food in Italy.
Right.
But no one's asking the question, can you make Italian food outside of Italy? Of course you can. And she's doing it and doing it really, really well.
But what's the reaction? You know, I hear you talking. It reminds me a little bit. I had, you know, Massimo Bottura was on the show. Mm-hmm. And when he first started doing his thing in Italy, mm-hmm. he got a lot of pushback from locally. You know, you can't do that with Italian food. Mm-hmm. And when I was hearing you talk a minute ago, it reminds me of that conversation we had because there is some similarity to me in a way between Southern food and Italian food. It's very, how do I put this? The food's very direct classically. Mm-hmm. Like it's not food that's put through, you know, the ringer. You know, the food's not put through a million steps the way, say, classic French food is, right?
There's a pun in there somewhere, Andrew, like the pasta machine.
But I mean, I think it has something to do with, but I think that's something it has in common with Italian food. You know, the final product is less removed from the original ingredients than it is in certain other cuisines. Does that make sense?
Yes, I would agree with that.
And yeah. And recipes tend to vary. This isn't a cliche about Italian food, but, you know, from home to home, you know, mm-hmm. based on how your mom did it, you know. This is stuff I feel like it has in common with Southern food. And when he started doing these radical kind of avant-garde things, people weren't very receptive to it. Right. It's funny now. He just won like best, you know, number one restaurant in the 50 best. But when I say that to you, does that resonate with you?
Everything you said resonates, and I would take it one step further. And my thinking on it was probably 2008 or 2009. It was before I had opened any restaurant, and I was very well aware of the difference between like Piemonte and Sicily. You know, they're mm-hmm. both Italy, but they're really, really different.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about Southern food in that way, variations of, say, Richmond, Virginia to New Orleans and the differentiation there. And then I started thinking about, well, in the 80s, I would dare to say before, you know, Mario Batali and the Food Network and all
yeah,
those things.
Yeah.
I don't think people were thinking about the regional variations of Italian cuisine.
No.
Pretty much at all.
No.
It was
Northern and
Italian,
Southern.
Well, just American Italian spaghetti and meatballs. You know what
right,
I'm saying?
Right.
So I started to think more deeply about how the South is really, the Southern cuisine really consists of these little micro cuisines. And that's kind of, that is what I based my book on,
mm-hmm.
is subdividing the South into five subregions.
Mm. Oh, that right. So that yeah. that actually does dovetail with the whole Italy
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where the idea sort of formulated for me was, man, look what happened to Italian food from the 80s up till now. It's
yeah.
arguably one of the most popular cuisines in America, if not the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not presenting the idea that Southern cuisine can be the most popular thing in the world, but it does certainly deserve to be called a cuisine, and it certainly does deserve to be understood on a deeper level of not just one bowl of grits that you like dump shrimp into. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, totally.
And that's very, going way back to your original question, that's a very frustrating point to try to get across to a population who might just want your fried chicken.
Yeah.
And it was always very, very complicated for me because
yeah.
I didn't want to explore fried chicken.
Right.
I started making fried chicken to help boost like a Tuesday night that was really slow.
Yeah, and then it kind of like overtook your place like a virus.
I'm not mad at fried chicken. Fried chicken is delicious. It's in my book. It's like I'm
right.
Fried chicken.
But
and
you
I
were
have
doing beautiful. You were doing beautiful things
that's
at Seersucker.
Focus on
beautiful.
You know?
I still
Absolutely.
Remember you had a dish with dumplings and in the broth. It was so good.
Yeah.
It was so revelatory to me.
I was into it.
So, I don't want to get your publisher upset because your book's not coming out for almost a year.
A little bit less than a year. It seems like it's
fall of 2019.
Yes, that's right.
Right. So you.
Did I get in trouble for talking about it?
What?
Will I get in trouble for talking about
it? Well, no, I'm going to protect you by not letting you go too far into it. But your collaborator was Jamie Feldmahr.
Correct.
It's called Searching for the South.
Seeking the
Seeking,
South.
It's called Seeking the South.
Yes, chef.
Is there a subtitle yet?
It's in the works.
Okay.
It's in the works.
Okay. So, but you break it down into five regions.
Correct.
Okay. And this is a new approach.
I don't.
You've never seen it?
No, there's one book that I found out there that was done. I found it in Virginia, actually. It kind of approaches it like this, but it's not what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
What do you think is the biggest miss? You know, okay, so I, this is weird, right? Because I grew up in Florida, which is southern. It's more geographically southern than anything, but it's not the South. At least not,
totally not.
South Florida is not the South.
Totally not.
Northern Florida might be the South.
I touch on
the panhandle.
A little bit.
Yep. Yeah. So
pretty much mullet.
But, you know, then I've been in, you know, I've been in New York since I was 17, been here a long time. I don't consider myself like, I don't feel like I grew up in the South. I don't think of myself as a Southerner. What do you think is the biggest misconception about the South as you've perceived it from people like me? About the food.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not getting into anything else, that's for sure. We'll leave that to meet the press or something. That everything's fried and there's not a lot of vegetables. I'd say that's the two biggest ones from It's hard for me to have perspective from the outside looking in what other people think about Southern cuisine because I'm so immersed in it.
Yeah.
But every town, even my mom's small, or my small town where my mom now still lives and my extended family, we have a farmer's market there. You know, and it's like a town of 10,000 people. And there are markets like that across the
it's
South.
It's like once a week?
In my hometown.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that the South is unique in that, but I am saying vegetables are really important to Southerners.
Right, but you are saying there is a farmer's market as opposed to like it's just Piggly Wiggly.
Oh, there's Walmart too. Don't worry about that. That's Walmart
country. Right.
To answer your question about the misconceptions, like everything's like goes to the deep fryer, which Southern food does have a lot of fried food.
Sure.
And there's reasons for that.
Yeah.
And that we don't eat a lot of vegetables, and that's just completely not true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there, but if we're honest, right, some of this has to do with the snobism from other regions, right? I mean, that's what it is.
What other regions?
I mean, other parts of the country. Don't you think that's why the people haven't invested the kind of time to think about this stuff, or?
Oh, man, that's... We're getting off on another exit now. I think
we don't have to.
No, we can go down whatever exit you want. I think when you start talking about things like that, you start talking about race relations and the dark history of the American South, which is a very dark period of time.
Mm-hmm.
We all know what I'm referring to, and it's sad and terrible, and should be acknowledged and should be examined and thought about more deeply. So by extension, when you start taking a look at how the cuisine is perceived, there's also, well, how is that region perceived? And you can't help but go look back at the ugly part of the history of the American South. So
when
that's for John T's podcast.
John T, every time you talk about the South, John T Edge inevitably comes up.
He's the guy.
He's the dude.
He's a great man. Like a four-leaf clover, like a penny bright.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Next year, Heritage Radio Network is turning 10. For the last decade, we've been committed to bringing listeners around the world the very best in food radio, for free. Our small staff and incredible network of hosts work hard so that listeners can tune in each week to hear the important conversations in food policy, stay on the cutting edge of cocktail culture, and hear the latest updates in food tech. But there is no HRN without the support of listeners like you. Become a member of Heritage Radio Network today and help HRN get a strong start to our second decade. Choose from exclusive member gifts and stay in the loop on discounts to upcoming events. There's no better time to show your support. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and wish HRN a happy birthday.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to get you to the rest of our interview with Chef Rob Newton in just a moment. But first, our usual reminders, if you would like to keep up with the show, the best free way to do that is simply to subscribe at iTunes or Stitcher, and our new shows will show up in your feed as they drop. That's the easiest thing to do. If for some reason you don't want to do that, you can follow us on Instagram. The handle is at Chef Podcast. Again, that is at Chef Podcast. We do post every time we drop a new episode, and you can link to it from our bio there. Also, if you'd be good enough to leave us a rating or review on iTunes, it really does help people find the show, and we really would appreciate it. And with that, here is the rest of our interview with Rob Newton, recorded a few weeks ago in New York City. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. But so the rest of the question I asked before, though, when you now take your act on the road, you go down to Nashville.
Made me sound like a circus clown.
But when you're cooking your take on this food in the actual South,
yeah,
did you change it? Did you change what you're doing because you're cooking? Like when you were in New York, you're cooking mostly for New Yorkers, right? Some people came here from
the
South.
Which is so fun. Hello, New York.
But, you know, people here are from everywhere, right?
Correct.
And when you're in Nashville, you have a lot of people who are from Nashville, who are from Correct. Nearby, who grew up on the food that you're riffing on.
There's a lot of people from Brooklyn and Nashville.
Are there?
Just me. Yeah.
Okay. Totally. But did you change what you do? Did you think about, like, did you try to second guess your dining public down there and
Not
make adjustments to what you do, or is this just that you just kept evolving as a chef and this was your next step?
Yeah, the latter, big time.
Yeah.
It's kind of a 2 or 3 part answer. I would say that the restaurant concepts, small as they were on Smith Street, were very specifically designed. I had a very distinct sort of vision for each one of them. And so when you have a restaurant that's so specifically Southern, that my interest in Vietnamese or Asian food as a whole somehow had to organically find its way into there, but it could have sometimes seemed out of place.
Yeah.
And I, you know, like just take Hoppin' John fried rice, for example, which is something that we did there for a long time. And before I knew about Kentucky soy sauce, I would deglaze with red eye gravy so I could get that sort of like umami kind of vibe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And why can't you do Hoppin' John fried rice? It's delicious. You know what I mean? So my interest in those things sort of found their way into that place. Same thing with like Nightingale, very, very specific street food Vietnamese vibe in the beginning. And then kind of as I spent more time in the South and traveled to Vietnam more, I just started seeing these similarities between the two that I still feel are very realistic and were kind of profound to me at the time. But I had designed a place that was so very specific in look and in feel and in menu to have my forays of my Southern heritage like creep into this Vietnamese place might seem kind of jarring, and it's just too much for a server to explain the things that I see in Vietnam that I find similarities to in the American South. That's a very long-winded way of saying I don't have to worry about any of that shit now because I'm just in a restaurant that I'm being paid to express myself
to do your thing,
and that's incredibly freeing.
Yeah,
and it's also a great coincidence and hopefully a benefit for Grain Dudley, the restaurant, and 21C, the hotel group, that I have a book coming out, and I'm exploring a lot of the stuff that I cover in my book in the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff that's in my book is already on the menu in the restaurant. So now I have a menu in a restaurant where I can have a country ham, shrimp, and pork lumpia.
What's lumpia?
Lumpia is like a Filipino spring roll, basically.
So it's fried?
Yes.
Okay.
But I can also have cornbread that's cooked in Benton's bacon fat.
Uh-huh.
And it's made with cornmeal from Kentucky on the same menu in the same place, and I find a way to make that harmonious.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just me doing my thing.
Did you tell me when we were having lunch earlier that you also have a banh mi on the menu?
Yeah, at lunchtime.
What do you do with that?
Fried chicken.
Oh, similar to what you used to do up here.
My mistress, yeah.
What do you mean your mistress? Fried chicken's your mistress?
Yeah, it's like
your mistress,
somebody you don't talk about. Whatever. It's delicious, you know. We don't need to get into the details of what's in it, but
so it sounds from this the way you're describing.
No, but one other thing I want to get to, I'm excited about, is like it's not the best Vietnamese food I've ever had in Nashville, but there's a lot of Vietnamese people there, and I have soup or pho for breakfast probably literally 4 or 5 times a week, and I go to this one specific place, and it's a Vietnamese family. They're from right outside of Saigon, and the dad does a lot of the food, which is very different than Vietnam. It's mostly all women doing the cooking. And I buy my baguettes from them for my banh mi.
Is that right?
Yeah, and they make their own pâte à choux, which is like a French-inspired little turnover, basically.
Mm-hmm.
My point is, that's a very cool thing that can happen in the American South, where a white guy like me, who loves Vietnamese food, can also buy bread in a quasi-Vietnamese bakery to serve in the restaurant where he's the chef.
That's so great.
That's the South that I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's probably stunning to a lot of people hearing this.
Same shit happens in New Orleans.
Yeah.
There's a great Vietnamese bakery in New Orleans on Chef Ventura Highway.
So it sounds to me like the food you're doing now, it sounds almost like an amalgamation of the three places you had up here, in a way.
Yeah, less Woman Jean, you know, because I don't do like straight up fried chicken.
You don't? No chicken on a stick? That was my personal favorite.
Yeah.
I don't know, that was so good.
Shit, yeah, that was good.
Okay,
yeah.
But more like Seersucker and Nightingale 9, sort of. You see elements of both of those.
I would say yeah, but I just feel like I've moved on to like other, just like this other thing.
Yeah.
I really am excited and inspired by Southern food, and that goes without saying, but I'm really inspired and excited by the recent immigrant arrivals who are here making, you know, living their own version of the American dream, regardless of what Donald Trump wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
There are Vietnamese families, the largest Kurdish population in America is in Nashville.
Is that right?
I go to Kurdish bakeries and get their breads, and they have their own sort of version of shawarma, and they have their own version of kibbeh, which is different than the Lebanese in America that lived in the Delta. There's Lebanese food in the Delta, and they have their own kind of kibbeh, and that shit's fascinating to me. Like, it's in my book, and I just really, I'm inspired by that. You know what I mean?
Yes.
That's the shit that gets me motivated, and that's the kind of stuff I want to explore.
But this is kind of amazing, right? Because you've been fascinated by these other cultures for years. You're not in your hometown, but you're back in the South, but you're able to sort of keep exploring.
It's chicken or the egg, right?
Within the South, though, some of these other cultures, which is has there always been a huge immigrant population like these
in the American South?
In Nashville, is that historically the case,
sure,
or is this a new thing?
My guess is I don't know. My guess is the Kurds came here after the first Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
Would be my guess because of Saddam Hussein. The Vietnamese obviously started coming after the fall of Saigon. There were a lot of distribution points. Sounds really harsh, but for example, in Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, which is not too far from where I'm from, was a major point where lots of Vietnamese families would come and be. I don't know what the American government would do in terms of documentation or get them their papers or whatever.
Processed.
And then that's the word, thank you. And then they would be distributed, which also sounds terrible, but they would be placed in other parts across America to keep them separate, to keep them from congregating. It was a really, I don't really know what the motivation behind the American government was to do that. It seems a little devilish to me. But anyway, a lot of them found themselves in New Orleans. A lot of them obviously found themselves out in Orange County in California. It's like one of the biggest.
Yep.
Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, there's a pretty decent little population of Vietnamese people in Nashville.
That's so interesting to me. Something that always struck me when you had your places in Brooklyn was you were very devoted to American products.
Sure.
You mentioned, was it Kentucky soy sauce?
Yeah,
What's the name of that brand that you always...
Bluegrass soy sauce.
Yeah. But what are some other products that people might be surprised are out there? Because you were able to get most of what, a lot of, almost so much of what you had in your kitchen from within the 50 states.
Sure. I mean, I don't know. I just feel, as a chef, you have some sort of obligation to use products that are close to you or that represent where you're from. And if you're going to be an American chef, I think you better serve American wines because there's a lot of good American wines out there. And I've always been a big proponent of that. You know, I felt really, really strongly from day one that if I was going to have a Southern restaurant and there's Southern wine out there, I damn sure better have it on my menu. Otherwise, I'm full of shit. So we had Virginia wine. And I still, to this day, love Virginia wine. I could pour us a Virginia wine, not right now because they're not in my house, but... That I think you would be really impressed and surprised by. Same thing about New York wines. I've been a fan of that for a long time. And there's a local component to that, but there's also like a Southern regional component to the Virginia thing.
Yeah.
And then if you zoom out and take a macro look at it, if you're going to be an American chef, you should promote American products. You know, and it doesn't mean that every single American wine is awesome or every single American wine... Or New York wine is awesome, and I know for certain that you'd probably agree with me that not every French wine you've ever had is amazing either.
No.
So you just have to do your work and explore and get to know the people who make these products and support them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's where I'm coming from.
But what are some other products that people might be surprised that you used in
from
your
the
kitchen?
American South
from,
or?
From the U.S.?
I mean, there's really good cured mullet that comes out of Florida. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. Everybody has salt now, but there's really good salt from West Virginia, and there's salt from all up and down the East Coast, but there's a good company in South Carolina that makes salt.
Mm-hmm.
That makes salt, that sounds weird, but produces
sea
salt. Country hams from across the American South are really important to me. I think it's one of the Southern cuisine's greatest contribution to American food is the country ham.
Right. I still remember going to Sambar for the first time, where he had like three different hams.
Yeah, I think.
What is it? It's the gravy.
Well, that it still makes me mad, but I think he did. Because nobody would put red eye gravy and mayonnaise together. That's just weird.
Oh, really?
Nobody would do that. But I think what he did for helping people understand American hams like has to be applauded. That's great.
But that was a brazen thing.
It's fantastic.
In that restaurant.
You just can't fuck around with red eye gravy like that.
But in that restaurant.
No disrespect.
In that restaurant, though, at that time on that menu,
dude.
It was really
Absolutely.
Striking. And for people who don't know what I'm
Benton's.
Saying is, there was one dish. I think it was an app.
Yeah,
and
just a plate of ham.
It was
awesome.
Three different hams with this bastardization of red eye gravy.
It's Edwards ham from Virginia. Benton's
definitely
from Tennessee.
Benton's. Yeah.
I don't remember the third. Oh, maybe it was burgers from the Ozarks, which is close
know.
To where I'm from. I don't remember.
But I just remember thinking that was stunning.
It's a revelation. Absolutely.
That was a stunning thing in that context.
All credit goes to there for helping get that movement going, for sure.
Yeah. So what was the book writing process like for you for the first time?
Oh, F-U-C-K. daunting, overwhelming.
What was the biggest surprise about it for you?
How much time writing all these damn recipes and then testing them? And then...
Did you test yourself?
I wrote, some came for the restaurant that like for previous sous chefs and I had all worked on, and then I would have to make them scalable.
Mm-hmm.
So the inspirations came from there. The other ones that I created for the book, I wrote myself. But the thing that surprised me is once I got done with all that shit, I had to pay somebody to do it again. Or me and Jamie had to pay somebody to do it again, which was just insane to me. But it's the right thing to do. It's a cookbook.
People, you mean you hired someone to cook their way through?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Good for you.
That's insane.
Did they catch a lot of tweaking
that
had to happen?
It. Of course. It's nuts. So that was really a surprise to me. I didn't know that was...
I have to tell people who are listening that is not... Not everybody does that.
Who in the hell tests the recipes then?
Well, like on books I worked on, I often tested.
Yeah.
But at home.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It was crazy. But I'm glad that we did it because... Every single recipe had some little something that you had to tweak and adjust.
Uh-huh.
And this giant Google Drive document is going back and forth with three recipe testers. Like, what do you mean here? What is this?
Yeah.
And like my head's going to pop off. You know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What did you learn? Did the exercise of doing the book and force you to... what did you learn about yourself doing it or about your food?
Oh, Jesus.
Did you come to any new realizations
really
about yourself?
Did I learn anything about myself?
Well, because most chefs, you're just going along. It's the next season. You do the next menu.
Yeah.
And then, but, you know, when you do a book, you have to kind of, you have to decide what makes the cut. You know, which recipes make the cut. You have to actually take your ideas and put them down on paper. You know, Alex Stupak was the very first ever guest on this show. And
I
he
remember.
Said that when he and Jordana Rothman were going through the process, that, you know, there had to be a reason for each recipe, right? And writing the head note or the introduction to each recipe, if they didn't have anything relevant or, you know, useful to say about it, it didn't make the cut. You know, but that also forced him to think about his food in a certain way.
That's some deep shit right there. I completely agree with all of that.
Yeah.
And I guess the thing I would say about that as it relates to me is that I think I do food that's fairly intricate, but not like molecular. I'm not really into that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I put together ingredients in a way that people sometimes might have difficulty connecting the dots, but all the dots connect in my head in the way that I see it, and it all, pretty much everything that I create, which sounds like a pretentious thing to say, I have some point of origin for it. And I kind of always knew that, but going through the process of writing this book sort of solidified it for me in a way.
Meaning everything you...
Like, I don't just pull shit out of the air and be like, oh, lumpia needs country ham in it. There's a reason, you know, there's a reason.
There's some antecedent to it.
Yeah, I have a reason for it. And I can, whether the guest or the reader of my book can connect those dots, I want them to be able to connect the dots, but it's also, like, not really...
necessary, if it tastes good.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely tastes good. I guess I'm saying that I know the dots connect, and that's what's really important to me. And as long as I make it taste good, and some people don't give a shit about the intellectual story behind it, and that's totally cool. I'm 100% fine with that. But if somebody wants to know about it, you know, I got a reason for it, and I'm happy to share it.
But are the reasons, like, how do I put this question? Like, when you say something where you would put ham in it, is the ham like a replacement for something that was in the original dish? Do you know what I'm saying?
Or... Well, let's just take the lumpia, for example. Okay. They're one of the first documented arrivals of Filipino culture was in the, I think, the 16th century in southern Louisiana, which probably wasn't even Louisiana at the time.
Right.
So I think about that, and then I think about... very, very large Filipino population on the coast of Virginia. A lot of them were there working in DOD contracts. So there's a big, you know, big naval base there. So there's a lot of, there's a strong Filipino culture going on the Virginia coast. And then I start thinking about Edwards Ham, which is really close to the Virginia coast, and Sam Edwards and all those guys. I love what they do.
Yeah.
And I start thinking about the Atlantic coast. And I start thinking about shrimp. And then I start thinking about pork, obviously, and I start thinking about country ham, and I start thinking about how Chinese culture uses their own version of country ham that I've seen with my own eyes in southern China, which blew my mind, which is a whole other show and a whole other book. And I just put all those things together in a way that makes sense to me, and then I make a sauce that's really acidic based on vinegar and sorghum and garlic and black pepper. And, like, if you think about adobo in Filipino cuisine, it's really acidic. It has a ton of black pepper. And then if you think about the American South, we have a lot of sorghum. And that's just how I connect the dots. And it all makes a lot of sense for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was stunning.
It's on the menu right now.
No, but it's stunning that you yourself can trace that intricate. You can trace those dots. You just went through, like, there were like 15. There was a chain of like 15 things.
Yeah, man. I don't know. It's just how... Yeah, it's just shit I like. That's what I like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Thanks.
We had an amazing trip years ago, and I just want to know what your memories of it are. We went to Chicago.
Oh, Jesus. I was telling the story the other day to a friend.
You and I and David Waltuck, who used to be the chef of Chanterelle. It's really criminal I haven't had David on the show yet. But
trip.
I was invited to interview Charlie Trotter the summer that he was closing his restaurant.
I really revered what he did.
I was going to go up there. David Waltuck knew Charlie a little. He wanted to go one more time. And then you and I were neighbors. You and I used to sometimes meet after we were done with work.
Sure.
And I was finishing writing at night, and we would go have a beer.
The good old days, meets.
The good old Brooklyn days.
Court Street.
Mini bar.
Court Street mini bar.
So,
oh my God.
South Brooklyn Pizza.
These are
our late night things.
See, there's a prime example of, like, America, like South Brooklyn pizza, 1 a.m.
Yeah.
Really good, delicious pizza being made by an Egyptian guy.
And it right? was
how good was he at making pizza?
So anyway, I mentioned that we were going, and you had said that Trotter was one of your heroes. So the three of us ended up going
so badass
on this 2-day trip of just eating so and good. Drinking our way through
Remember
Chicago.
Conan O'Brien at Spiaggia?
Was he there that night? No, I have no recollection of that. So we went. We ate at the Purple Pig.
I remember outside. We ate outside.
We Girl and the snuck Goat, in. Right? Did we go to we Girl snuck and Goat? In a meal between lunch and dinner at Girl and the Goat.
Oh my God! Then we liked the food there.
Then we went to Spiaggia.
Jesus.
We had a private lunch in the kitchen at Trotter's.
Yeah, we got to tell more about. You can't just drive by that one.
And we went to Alinea,
which was amazing.
Yeah. What are your memories of that trip? This was almost, this had to be...
4, 5,
no, no,
six.
No. This was 2012. So 6 years ago.
Yeah. My memories of that trip are incredibly fond. I remember I remember the plan was to have lunch, but to be completely honest, I didn't know they weren't open for lunch.
I didn't either till that day.
Didn't know that we were going to be in the fucking kitchen. When Chef Trotter's going to sit down with us.
Right. So what happened
was insane.
He heard who was coming with. I mean, this was, let's be honest, it wasn't
because
of me, or you. It had to do with David Waltuck.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chef, if you're out there listening.
And his publicist said,
yeah.
Charlie would like to invite you guys to lunch, and then Andrew, you can do your interview after lunch. And I didn't realize, and I guess you didn't either, I don't know if we talked about it, but I looked at their website that morning.
Like Larry Stone was there doing the wine? It was nuts.
So we go, and we were at a private table in the kitchen. He had each of his chefs de partie bringing us a dish that they had made.
Dude, it's so crazy.
And he kind of came and went and sat with us. But how did
you,
and you had never met him before.
No, I'd eaten there twice prior, and I'd always been with industry people, and he was always very gracious. I think one time we didn't even get a bill, and we got these big, gigantic wine glasses that he was known for. We had all these amazing wines, because the two times I went, I was like a broke-ass line cook, and he appreciated that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He was so incredibly generous.
Yeah. Wait, so you had met him or you hadn't?
I don't know if I even actually met him, but I'd eaten at the restaurant. I don't know if he even came to the table, to be honest. I don't recall.
So what was that lunch like for you? Because that was a crazy
surreal.
Day.
Yeah. It was surreal. Really delicious. Really intricate and delicious. And it was almost like looking through the peephole of... I'd spent a lot of time hovering over his books and thinking about what it might be like. And like I said, I'd been lucky enough to eat there twice prior.
Yeah.
So it was surreal.
Yeah.
It was like almost like, man, I don't know if I should be here, but of course I was, and of course I felt like I deserved to be there, and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. But
yeah,
I was just really honored and humbled. It was great.
Did I ever tell you what I did? I don't know if I ever told any of you.
No.
So I wasn't. Sometimes I get a little sick when I fly.
Okay.
I've long since figured out how to not have that happen.
All right.
So I was going to the men's room a few times.
Okay.
And
in the airplane?
No. At that lunch.
Okay.
And so I noticed, this is kind of a weird thing to mention, but...
Oh, God.
No. So the toilet paper roll was, you know, they folded it into like a little triangle.
Okay.
Right? And when I went back the second time, I noticed that someone had gone in there and they're not open. We're the only people there.
Yeah, somebody's doing that.
So then I went a couple of extra times just to like, because we were there for a few hours, just to tear off the triangle and see if they would, and every time.
You devil you.
But every time they did it, I was so impressed by that.
I have two things to add to that in the realm of Charlie Trotter. One is, two things really involving one book. He has this book. It was, it's not the Kitchen Essentials one. It's like a leadership book that he wrote,
mm-hmm.
and there's lots of many small little chapters. And one thing relating to the OCD is I recall in this book that he was so maniacal about keeping the carpets clean that he'd have the staff wear Velcro, like a reverse Velcro on their
Velcro
shoes.
Velcro or Scotch tape
like,
or something.
Something
on
that.
The bottom of their shoes.
Yeah,
yes, because it would pick up lint. Because it would pick up lint.
It's totally insane.
Why is that insane?
That's pretty... That's what vacuums are for. I don't know. It's kind of
crazy.
But I could also see myself, if I let myself go, I could also do that too.
Because
I have a lint brush with me all the time because I'm insane. But the bigger one and potentially more disturbing is the book is in all these little chat. I can't remember what the book is called, but it's out there. There's a chapter called Effective Leadership Through Fear and Intimidation.
That's an actual chapter?
I'm paraphrasing, but it's something like that. And I just always thought that that was really bizarre. He was so psychologically motivated. You know what I mean? Like
he's to me one of the great,
like almost like a philosopher. You know?
Oh, that's for sure.
Totally.
But he was also such a fascinating character, because on the one hand he could be very difficult, and on the other hand
so gracious, and generous.
Generous was a defining thing, and. And I've always said this, you know, his two best industry friends were Norman Van Aken and Emeril Lagasse, who were like two of the most genial, nice dudes you'll ever meet,
right.
You know, and I always thought that spoke very highly of him. Anyway, Rob, it was so great to have lunch with you today.
So fun.
Thanks for making the time during your trip to New York.
I'm honored, man. Like I said in the beginning, I'm a fan of the show. I think you're doing important work and talking to all these different chefs about what they do.
Thank you.
and I'm honored to be on the show. I wish I would have done it sooner.
I'm glad to have you here. We tried.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah,
we did.
We did. Okay.
Thanks, buddy.
Enjoy the rest of your stay.
Thanks, man.
And that's our show for today. As I have been saying during this holiday time, Vitor and Kat, thank you so much for your extra work getting these shows up during the off season. I appreciate it that you're doing it from wherever you are. And I'm sure listeners do too. Rob Newton, thank you for making time for me during a short visit to New York City. It was great to see you and catch up. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening. And we will see you back here in a few days on Andrew Talks to Chefs.